The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
I think Sherlock Holmes not only likes scientific experiments and is always working in the laboratory, but he thinks like a scientist.
Maria Konnikova is here to discuss her new book on how we can all think like Sherlock Holmes. And...
The problem about breathing is when you talk to someone about it, then thinking about it will affect their breathing.
Professor Anita Simmons is a specialist in breathing and the disorders associated with it. She'll be here to tell us about her life-saving work. We'll also be discussing the news, how we can use DNA to store Shakespeare's sonnets, why antibiotic resistance is more worrying than ever, and is mackerel really running out? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Maria Konnikova is a writer and graduate student in psychology at Columbia University in New York. She writes the weekly Literally Psyched column for Scientific American. She's also a self-confessed fan of Sherlock Holmes and became fascinated with how this fictional 19th century detective seemed to embody so many of the most cutting-edge ideas about how the brain works, ideas that were being discovered by psychologists and neuroscientists at the start of the 21st century. She came into the studio earlier to tell me more about it. Maria, welcome to the podcast. So Sherlock Holmes is often called the scientific detective. He uses logic and deduction to get to the root of all his puzzles. Let's start with this question. Is Sherlock Holmes a scientist?
I think he is. I think Sherlock Holmes not only kind of likes scientific experiments and is always working in the laboratory, but he thinks like a scientist. You can really see Conan Doyle's own scientific training in this character, and I don't think it's an accident that Sherlock Holmes was modeled after Dr. Joseph Bell, who was himself a physician.
So tell us a bit more about him, and how did the character sort of develop? We'll talk about Conan Doyle a bit later. He himself, towards the end of his career, started discussing, let's say, non-scientific things. But at this point of creation, he created a very strongly scientific character. Who was it based on? Where did it come from?
So it came from Dr. Joseph Bell, who was Conan Doyle's mentor at the University of Edinburgh. And Bell was a physician who had keen powers of observation and deduction. So he not only could tell the diagnosis of a patient, but over the years he had come to read people so well that he could tell you a lot about their background. For instance, if you know in the Sherlock Holmes stories, there's that famous exchange between Holmes and Watson where they first meet, and Holmes is able to tell that Watson came from Afghanistan. And if you look at Dr. Joseph Bell, there was one famous moment where he not only was able to diagnose the patient, but he said, oh, I think this is a retired colonel from the Scottish Highlands who has just returned from Barbados. So that exchange sounds rather familiar to fans of Sherlock Holmes.
And what was it about Sherlock Holmes that sort of drew you to writing about it? You're a graduate student of psychology. So what drew you to sort of examining his work and then fitting what is a very modern science, neuroscience, psychology? Mm-hmm. These are really modern things that Conan Doyle wouldn't have had a clue about. But how does that fit into your interest?
Well, I was really stunned when I reread the stories to see just how accurate Conan Doyle's insights into psychology were, that he really presaged a lot of the developments in modern neuroscience, especially when it came to kind of the central characteristic of Holmes's thinking, which is mindfulness. Mindfulness research is really in its infancy right now in terms of the actual neuroscience of it. You know, the last 10 years have really seen an explosion in this type of work. But Sherlock Holmes not only embodies the principles of mindfulness, but the way that he does and the results, the effects on his thinking. Right now we're seeing that kind of scientifically from a psychological standpoint, they're incredibly accurate.
So what is mindfulness? This is, as you say, a newish area of neuroscience and psychology. And how does it fit into things we might be familiar with?
So mindfulness is just the ability to focus on the present moment and to resist distraction. So mindfulness doesn't mean you won't get distracted. It means that you're present enough and cognizant enough of your own thinking that you'll recognize those distractions and be able to dismiss them. So you can say, you know, hi, distraction, nice to meet you. Please go away now. I want to go back to focusing on the present moment. And yes, it's hard. And it's especially hard, you know, now in the 21st century, probably more difficult than it was in the 19th.
And so this is, it edges onto things like well-being and meditation as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, Holmes famously often takes two or three pipes worth of tobacco to come up with a problem. This is a three-pipe problem. It means he's thinking. He's meditating, essentially, isn't he?
He is. He is essentially meditating. And often, you know, you see all these moments in the stories where he's just sitting in his chair with his eyes closed, his fingers crossed. And what he's doing is mindfulness meditation. He's focusing on the present moment, and he's letting his kind of thoughts just percolate in his mind so that he can solve problems without really ever leaving his chair. He understands the importance of that sort of mental space, and I don't think we take that space often enough.
Well, let's talk about them, what you call the brain attic. This is a way of sort of structuring the thoughts in your head so that you can make deductions from them. So how does Holmes do it, and then how is that useful to us?
So Holmes understands that, you know, if you look at the analogy of an attic, there's a finite space up there, and it matters what you put there, and it matters how you store it. So you can put all sorts of junk up there, and then you end up with a sort of Watsonian brain, or you can be mindful about what types of items go into your attic. And then if they're worthy of storage, how exactly do you store it? So you need to know that you should label the box. You should label it as well as possible. You should tie it as much as possible to what you already have in your attic, to kind of existing contents, because memory works by association and by personal relevance. So the more points of encoding we have, the more likely we will be able to access that memory at a later point in time, and it won't get lost kind of in the jumble of the attic space. And what we choose to store and how we choose to store it really influences how we think at any given moment, because the information that's in our minds, that's the information that is affecting our thinking, that's affecting the way we're perceiving the world.
I mean, it sounds a bit like the memory palace that some people talk about. So we had Joshua Foer on the podcast last year. He's wrote the wonderful book about memory and getting your memory, improving your memory. Mm-hmm. And he talked about creating crazy narratives around an event. Mm-hmm. So his book was called Moonwalking with Einstein, as you must know him, obviously.
Yes.
And so this idea is, if you remember that idea of moonwalking with Einstein, that's such a strange idea that you can link it to memory. So is this what he was doing? And how do we start to do this? I mean, as non-Holmes mortals?
Well, as non-Holmes mortals, we don't need to necessarily moonwalk with Einstein to make something memorable. We can tie it to personal experience, to something in our past. We can tie it to emotions. You know, emotional memories are much easier to remember than non-emotional ones. We can tie it to different senses, and this is something that Holmes does incredibly well. We tend to over-rely on our vision. It's kind of the easiest sense to spot. And a lot of our other senses, like smell, are the invisible senses because we just ignore them. We don't use them as inputs, but they influence us all the same. So if we are mindful of their existence, we can use them as points of encoding. So when we want to remember something, the more sensory associations we have with it, the more likely we are to be able to remember it. But I think the idea of a mind palace is an incredibly useful one. You know, as an attic space is as well, you can really, the second that you start picturing it as a three-dimensional space, you can use our spatial memory, which is much better, and try to improve to the point where we see where something is in the attic. You know, we don't just think we're going to put it in the attic. We visualize where in the attic we're going to be storing it, and that makes us once again more likely to be able to then come back to that attic and retrieve the right box.
Memory is one thing, but Sherlock Holmes is famous if for nothing else than to deduce answers from things that he's seen and remembered. So he's going through that palace and actually examining the contents in fresh ways each time, which seems like an order of magnitude task more difficult. Is that really feasible for normal people? And what does modern neuroscience and psychology say about all of this? I mean, about how our memories are structured. What have you found out in that way?
I think it is feasible if we take a page from Sherlock Holmes and use it as a three-pipe problem. We have to understand that our subconscious mind is also incredibly powerful, and that one of the best ways to navigate our attic and to realize what's in there, even if we might not consciously remember it, is to give ourselves time to think. So Holmes does this incredibly well, be it by smoking his pipe, by playing the violin, by going to the opera, by going to a museum. He has all sorts of things that he can do that will free up his mind to really work on this. And if you talk about the neuroscience of it, he's engaging the default mode network, which is the network of connections that's active when our brain is in its resting state, so when we're really not doing much of anything. And what it does in the resting state is monitor the environment, both internal and external. And so it's able to spot connections that we wouldn't necessarily spot otherwise. And it's something that is truly feasible if we slow down a little bit, if we realize that taking time out is helpful and makes us more productive, if we don't see it as wasting time. I think it's a question of mindset. We often think we're wasting time if we're not doing anything. But if we want to be able to deduce and to kind of problem solve the way Holmes does, it can be an incredibly important thing to do.
So doing nothing doesn't mean checking Twitter for 3 hours or emails or something. That's doing negative things.
Yes.
Well, maybe. So another sort of parallel to the book, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is was Daniel Kahneman's recent book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. So you've got these two systems, one which thinks very quickly and makes judgments and gut feelings, mm-hmm. and then thinking slow. So you call them System Watson and System Holmes in the book. System Watson is the thinking fast one, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. and thinking slow is the Holmes one. So what my question is that what's the point of Dr. Watson? Because, you know, he's the kind of touch point where sometimes he just asks dumb questions so that Holmes can explain things as a literary device. But more importantly than that, could you have Holmes, the thinking slow bit, without Watson, the thinking fast bit?
No, I don't think you can. I think System Watson or System One, thinking fast, is incredibly important. First of all, it uses fewer cognitive resources. I'm not saying Watson himself necessarily uses fewer. Yes, he's a doctor, so he's perfectly capable of using cognitive resources, and he's smart. I mean, he's not a bumbling fool. He's quite intelligent. But it's good to think in System Watson a lot of the time. You know, it's not. We don't always need to be like Sherlock Holmes. There are moments when it's fine to kind of use those fast processes. Our brains are very smart, and a lot of those heuristics help us decide correctly a lot of the time. What System Holmes does is help us reflect in those moments where we need to reflect, where we need to slow down, where it's more important for us. But it learns from System Watson. There's a constant back and forth. You know, the mistakes of System Watson can be picked up by System Holmes, and System Holmes can feed back into System Watson to make it better, so that if you have that feedback often enough, System Watson can start thinking a little bit more like System Holmes in a way.
But the System Watson, the thinking fast bit, is actually, you know, it's necessary for normal life, isn't
yes.
it? You can't wait for all evidence to turn up. So the books were written in the 19th century. Obviously, psychology and neuroscience has come huge amounts since then. And in the 21st century, this is one of the big sciences for this coming century. We're at the beginning of our understanding, and your book sort of talks about all the experiments and the sort of techniques that we're using to try and understand our brains. At the same time, we've got a rewriting of Sherlock Holmes on the BBC. We've had Benedict Cumberbatch and his new set of stories. And what I find interesting about those is they're not the same stories as before. They're the same characters, but they're not the same stories. Do you see in there an indication of this knowledge of how the science has moved on in that time? In the olden days, Conan Doyle was sort of, this is just a character for him. And it turns out that there was some scientifically valid ideas. In the modern one, they could take advantage of this, couldn't they?
They could. And I think the modern adaptation is incredibly well done because it is true to the spirit of Holmes. And you do see these moments of mindfulness. You do see now how Holmes processes information. And I think they can visually show it in a way that's much more compelling than Conan Doyle could write about it, because we do have this greater understanding of how it's actually working. So I get a sense that the writers of the show, while they might not be aware of all of the neuroscience per se, they do understand some of the principles of how this is happening.
He certainly doesn't smoke pipes anymore.
No, he does not. He has the nicotine patches.
Nicotine patches, that's right, which is a way out. And Watson's a much more interesting character, I think.
He is.
He's a real, he has his own sort of, he's not sort of so subservient to Holmes at all,
which is important because I think System Watson, if we think about it in the brain sense, is incredibly important. And I don't think Holmes would be Holmes without Watson. Watson helps him be a better thinker. When Holmes talks things through to Watson, he sees flaws in his logic that wouldn't be apparent otherwise.
It's also worth talking a bit about the sort of flaws sometimes in behavioral psychology research. And this is not an area that's without controversy. For example, a lot of the studies around things like priming, this idea that if someone says old words to you, what are the old words? Wrinkles and Florida and those sorts
the
of things.
Florida
the Florida effect, that's right. So if someone says that to you, then you're more likely to walk out of a room slowly. Whereas if they say young type words, then you walk out faster. And it's a very compelling idea. It's being challenged, though. Like all science is, these things change.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of steer that line between, this is a really interesting result which Holmes might have used and we can use as well. How do you steer between that and, it turns out that something is actually not very incisive at all because psychological experiments can have all sorts of biases themselves?
That's a really important question, and I think it's something that social and cognitive psychology especially need to deal with. And the way that I've tried to deal with it in the book is to only include results that have been replicated multiple times. I think we have to be incredibly hesitant when there's just a new study that has a really cool effect to take it as gospel until it's been replicated multiple times. And John Barge's work on the Florida effect, it has been replicated often. We just know that priming is a fragile phenomenon. You have to do it correctly. And the moment that someone's aware of the prime, it stops working. So I think that even though that work is being challenged, enough people have replicated it that the effect is probably there. It might not be as strong. There might be some caveats to it, but that specific effect, I think priming is a strong force. We do have to, though, be incredibly skeptical of any new results, especially when they're counterintuitive, because there's also a publication bias towards more radical results than ones that have that just do the same old thing again.
Quite. I mean, I'm sure you're highly aware of, especially the frauds and all sorts of things that have been going on the last few years. And psychology sort of has a little bit of an image problem, isn't it, that respect?
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of scientific publications.
Yeah, the incentives are all out of whack because there are so many incentives to publish and to publish cool results. And so I think that people are becoming tempted to fudge the data a little bit to make things look a little bit more striking.
Just finally, you've been in London for a few days. Have you gone to the famous address? Have you knocked on the door?
I have. I've knocked on the door. I've gone up the steps. I forgot to count whether there were actually 17. I just realized.
you see, but you don't observe. Isn't that the
line? I saw and I did not observe. I was too cold. It was very cold in the museum.
Was it exciting? How did you feel?
They've done such a wonderful job. I thought it was wonderfully evocative. I enjoyed seeing kind of the Victorian trappings. I think the temperature was probably part of the Victorian age. They wanted it to be more authentic.
We made it cold just for your visit. That's
yes.
Right. Maria, thank you so much for all of that. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
That was Maria Konnikova, and her book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, is published by Canongate and out now. Let's move on to some of this week's big science news stories. To discuss some of those, we've got Guardian science correspondent Ian Somble. Welcome, Ian.
Hello.
And the editor of the environmentguardian.co.uk website, Adam Vaughan. Adam, welcome.
Hello.
It's been a while since you've been on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start off with the story. This is the big story this week about antibiotic resistance. Ian, Dame Sally Davis, the chief medical officer of the UK government, was in front of a parliamentary committee, and she said some quite disturbing things about the apocalypse coming. Not the 2012 apocalypse. That didn't happen. So what was she talking about?
So this whole idea of antibiotic resistance is obviously not new, and you know, scientists have been talking about this for a long, long time, and you know, the idea that diseases, infections have been becoming resistant to antibiotics is as old as antibiotics themselves. What happened?
Just explain what that means. Just so the idea is that an antibiotic is used to kill bacteria, but the bacteria evolve so quickly that they become resistant. And we've gone through several generations of antibiotics and we're running out.
Yeah, well, I could just let you describe
it. Yeah. I just thought I'd give some background. Go on.
Yeah, so this is natural selection, right? So as soon as you start using antibiotics on bugs, you kill off the weaker ones more quickly. The hardier ones survive, they multiply, you end up with hardier strains, la, la, la. On you go, generation after generation, and so you end up with resistance building into bacteria pretty much across the board. Now, we've known about this for a long time. What happened last week is that the The most senior advisor, medical advisor to the UK government, Dame Sally Davis, the chief medical officer, told MPs on the Science and Technology Committee that she wants to have the issue of antimicrobial resistance put on what we call the National Risk Register of Civil Emergencies, which is the UK government's sort of big bad list of stuff that might go down in the UK that the public should know about and businesses should know about. And if you look at that list, at the moment, things on there are catastrophic terrorist attacks, pandemic flu, and another one is major flooding of the type that this country saw in 1953, which was actually the last time the UK declared a formal national emergency. So it's an old issue that she has raised ahead of a report that she actually has coming out in March, which is going to be quite strong on telling GPs and clinical professions how to be sort of better stewards of antibiotics, keeping them back essentially, so that you try and reduce the rate at which antibiotic resistance develops.
So we've had for generations now advice from doctors and others to say, look, stop taking antibiotics if you don't need them. If you are prescribed them, take the full course. Don't just like keep half of them, because that's what a lot of people, I'm sure we all know, do, is that they take half antibiotics for 3 days out of seven, then keep the rest for some other time, which is an incredibly bad thing to do in terms of creating new bacteria out there that are resistant to this stuff. So it's kind of all of our faults, but also it's the fault, isn't it, of pharmaceutical companies who don't research this stuff anymore, or are doing it at a much smaller scale. Just explain that a little bit.
So what happened is, since in the last 60 years, you can basically look at the big pharmaceutical companies coming up with three generations of antibiotics. You kick off with formulations of natural antibiotics, penicillin and such like. 20 years, they last you about 20 years and bugs become resistant to those. Then what you do is you modify those. You make synthetic types of those drugs, synthetic kind of antibiotics, penicillins and so on, and you just change the chemical side groups on those molecules, and it prevents the bacteria from breaking them down. So you can use those for another 20 years. That was generation two. Generation three, you put some more modifications into the kind of the core backbones of these molecules and make them more resistant. Now, the drugs we have at the moment, the most advanced and sort of the most powerful antibiotics we have at the moment, are called carbapenems. Now, they are the last generation. There is no fourth generation antibiotic. And in the last 20, 25 years, there have been no new antibiotics coming through. The one we have now, carbapenems, which are really powerful, bugs have started showing resistance to those. And the first cases cropped up in the UK in 2003 through till about 2007. It was literally one or two cases. Since then, they've leapt up to over 300 a year. In 2010, which is the last figures I could find, the first half of that year, there were a couple of hundred. So what's interesting about this is, though, is that the resistance in bacteria that are being seen, the gene that makes these bacteria resistant, can swap about between different types of bugs. So it's not just we're looking at, say, C. difficile, Clostridium difficile, which we know to be a problem bug, or MRSA. The actual antibiotic resistance jumps between bacteria, and that means that you can get all kinds of infections becoming resistant to our last sort of last plan of drugs.
Adam, one of the things that Dame Sally also said, I mean, this was sort of a side comment, was that you know, if we don't have new antibiotics in 20 years' time, it might be that you go in for a routine operation and you die of the complications of a common infection because we haven't got an antibiotic to fix it. She said she even invoked the dread word in your subject, climate change. She said that it's worse than most of us won't see the effects of climate change because we won't survive that. And that, let's not take these things out of context. But does it worry you? I mean, does this sort of stuff worry you?
I think the thing that worries me most about in reading the warnings this week and just sort of the ongoing story, the thing that worries me about where the onus is put, really, it feels like, you know, certainly the way that this story is played out, it often feels like the blame is laid at, you know, the patient's door, you know, that this is something that, you know, is part of our sort of modern culture. Rather than just take some time off work and rest, we go to our GP and we plead for a course of antibiotics to try and get it sorted quickly. I just feel like, you know, clearly that should, to me, the main thing seems to be that should not be where the blame lies. You know, this is something for the NHS and the medical community to take on board. And I mean, GPs are professionals, you know, they should feel like they can say no. And have the backing to do that. I mean, it just seems daft that this story is starting to play out, that of kind of like, you know, like it feels like you're blaming malingerers basically rather than
And certainly when I was talking about people not taking courses of antibiotics earlier, I meant people who are properly prescribed them and then don't finish them. I mean, we know those people. Ian, just to wind us up though, are there new antibiotics potentially or new types of drugs that could solve
there are some new ideas out there? Yeah, there's one of the interesting ones I was hearing about was, instead of I spoke to some researchers at Imperial College in London who were saying that they didn't think actually a next antibiotic was actually the answer. That instead of carrying on in this arms race with bacteria, you know, this is an evolutionary arms race. The bacteria, you know, develop and we come up with something to kill them and then they get defenses, so on and so forth. Instead of just coming up with another bacteria and then that becoming another drug and that becoming useless in another few years, these guys are saying, no, don't bother doing that. Instead of banging your head against the wall doing that, try and actually improve people's resistance to these things. So people are coming up with techniques to actually boost our immune systems often, but our defenses, so you can stop the bacteria getting into our blood system. For example, like so gastrointestinal bacteria, you can try and contain them and so that you're basically more resilient to them. And that's something that bacteria can never become immune to.
Well, as Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park, life will find a way. Adam, let's move on to one of your stories. This week, mackerel was taken off the conservationist's fish to eat list, due, I'm assuming, to overfishing and a lack of population. Take us through what's going on, and what does this say about what we can and can't eat from the wild?
As you saw, there was a lot of hoo-ha about mackerel being taken off the menu as it was spun, and the fishing industry hit back quite hard, saying, this was a ruling from the Marine Conservation Society, who are a very respected bunch, and you had Sea Fish and the other trade bodies for the fishermen coming back and saying, you can ignore this, you can skip their advice for this year. The reality is mackerel have been moving in the northeast Atlantic, have been moving north and west towards Iceland and the Faroe Islands. And the Faroese and the Icelandic have basically decided they're going to fish more. Since 2010, they've been unilaterally fishing well over quota. The population isn't actually a problem. So the latest scientific advice issued last September actually shows that there's quite a lot of biomass up there of mackerel. The problem is the rate at which they're fishing them. It's almost twice as many tons as they should be, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of
so
tons.
So we're on
of
a bad
mackerel.
Trajectory.
We're moving in the wrong direction, and I think what the Conservation Society here are trying to do is just sort of preemptive, before it gets really bad, let's do something about this. And this is really a political problem. Iceland and the Faroe Islands have been at loggerheads with the EU and Norway.
What's their argument?
Their argument is that more of this fish is now in our waters. We're going to have it, thank you very much. And Norway and the rest, which is Norway has historically been the source of most of it. Norway and the rest of the EU are not happy about that. The UK has been trying to get a deal on it for ages.
From a conservation point of view, though, you said that the trajectory is in the wrong direction. And that potentially speaking, in several years' time, there could be a real drought of these fish. What's the truth? Should people go out and eat mackerel? Because that's all we want to know. Should you go out and eat it? There is enough, but there isn't enough.
It's actually quite simple. You can go out and eat mackerel. It depends where it comes from. If you can be bothered to ask your fishmonger or your supermarket where it comes from. If it comes from the UK, that's absolutely fine. There's plenty of...
This isn't a nationalistic thing here, Adam.
No, I'm not trying to help my friends down in Cornwall or anything like that. But, if you can still buy mackerel. And also, bear in mind that they're not saying don't ever eat it. They're saying their advice is occasional. I mean, I asked them what occasional means and they got very vague and said as long as a piece of string. But, it's not off the menu.
Do we know why they've moved more towards Iceland and the Faroe Islands? And is this like a temporary thing? Is that a permanent shift in their population?
Better banking situation, I think. Adam?
I'm not going to make any banking analogies, but the jury's out. The theories are that their food, what they feed on, has moved in that direction, northwest, and they followed it. There's also speculation that it could be to do with temperature rises. So we could be back at our old bogeyman of climate change. It's not clear yet. All we know is that they're a migratory fish, they're moving, you know, and that's where they are now, and that is why they're being fished in. I mean, the thing that jumped out to me was that in 2007-06 thereabouts, Iceland and Faroe Islands were responsible for 0% of mackerel catch. They're now responsible for about 30%. So, you know, it's
quick.
It's quite a big jump.
Let's move onwards to our third and final story. Ian, this is back to you. Shakespeare's sonnets and Martin Luther King's famous speech have been encoded in The Stuff of Life. This is research coming out of scientists who have been instrumental in some major sequencing projects, including the ENCODE project, which looked at the dark matter of the genome. Now they're sort of trying to use genetics, Ian, in a very different way to describe what's been going on.
So this was from Nick Goldman and Ewan Burney at the European Bioinformatics Institute up near Cambridge. And they say they cooked this kind of idea up over a beer in a pub in Hamburg. Although it's, to be fair, I think the paper took so long to come out that a group at Harvard beat them to it and published a paper on this very thing last summer. But anyway, what they've done is they were looking at how tough it gets to store the vast data sets that you're getting in biology now. You keep these things on hard disks, you keep them on magnetic tape still, which is pretty energy intensive and bulky and clunky and all the rest of it. And so they thought, well, why not, see if we can store stuff in DNA, because DNA obviously stores information. So what they've done is they worked out how you can use the sort of four letters, if you like, the GCTNA, the bases of the genetic code, to store digital information. And you can store any digital information you like with this. You can store audios, pictures, images, videos, you name it, anything you can store on a computer. And what they did to demonstrate this is they stored all of 154 of Shakespeare's sonnets, some audio from Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream, the seminal Crick and Watson paper from 1953, I think it was, on the double helix, and also a picture of their institute. And that information in DNA occupies, a kind of little bit of dust, speck inside a test tube smaller than half of your little finger. And it's really interesting what they did. I mean, after cooking up this code, which interestingly, it uses these bases and in a way such that, so T in sonnet 18 of like, thou art more lovely, T would be T-A-G-A-T, and you have the code so that no two letters are ever reproduced, are never consecutive, because that's a kind of an error that you can get in reading and writing synthetic DNA. Anyway, they send off, they encode all of this information, send it off to a company called Agilent in California. They make the physical DNA and send it back. And in Cambridge, they basically resuspend the DNA, put it through a sequencer, and they read out their information again, and they can reconstruct the science paper from Crick and Watson, all of Shakespeare's sonnets and so on. So what this was just a very lovely demonstration of how much information you can store in DNA, and also how you can do it with a kind of error protection system.
Yeah, so, I mean, it sounds awfully clever. I suppose the important question is, does this DNA drive work with a Mac? I suppose seriously, the question it raises for me is why.
What's the advantage?
A brilliant proof of concept, but hard drives have never been cheaper, and of classic, cost curve going down. I don't see the point.
Yeah, this isn't the fastest or cheapest way you would ever store anything. And what is appealing about it in some sense is that you can store information in DNA pretty faithfully, especially if you have the kind of error protection system that they built into it for tens of thousands of years. And you know that because you can dig up woolly mammoths in the Siberian permafrost, and they've just been lying in the ice, and you can pull out the DNA and read it. So you know that DNA can store information faithfully over extraordinary amounts of time that you couldn't hope to store on a magnetic tape or a disk. It's just not going to last that long. Now, the advantage is that once you've written something into DNA, all you need to do is keep it cold and dry, and you're home. That will be stable for a hell of a long time. It's not mutating anymore.
It's just a dream for artifacts.
But so there comes a point where you think, well, at what point? It costs an awful lot of money to make DNA. That's the expensive bit, synthesizing the DNA into these letters. The reading it is a lot cheaper. but it's still a lot more expensive. Now, these guys worked out what sort of time period would you need to store something over for it to be valuable, because, you know, when you store it, as long as you've got it somewhere dry and cold, you don't need to be, you know, doing having all the cost of storing something digitally with electricity and so on like that. And they worked out that, what I liked, one of the calculations they did was, if the cost of making DNA was 100 times cheaper, and we've already had a 100-fold drop in the cost of making DNA over the past decade, so this isn't unrealistic. If that cost comes down another 100 times, if you were storing something for over 50 years, it would be economically viable. So in a gram of DNA, you could store all the information that you get in, say, a million CDs, more than a million CDs. So that gives you some idea about how dense this thing is as a storage medium.
What I'm curious about is why people still use CDs as the analogy of the basic storage unit. I mean, surely DVDs, if nothing else.
It's in the journalistic SI units.
We should be on Blu-ray, right?
Surely, we should be on Blu-ray by at now, least. If nothing else.
Why are we still talking about optical media? We can't buy computers without disk drives these days.
Guys, thank you very much. We'll leave it there. Adam, Ian, thank you both very much. To read more on any of these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk. Now, a selection of those stories also makes it onto our new and free audio edition.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Luke Harding reports from Mali as the French army retake territory from jihadist forces. Peter Bradshaw gives 5 stars to Steven Spielberg's film Lincoln. And in this week's audiobook review, we discover the world of Jane Austen's most beloved character, Elizabeth Bennet. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/guardianaudio or find us on SoundCloud, Audioboo, and in iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Breathing is so natural that we never really think about it. Indeed, the only time you do think about it is when you can't do it. When that happens, whether it's a medical emergency born from an accident or due to conditions such as muscular dystrophy, that's when you need the work of someone like Professor Anita Simmons. She's a specialist in sleep and breathing disorders at the National Heart and Lung Institute and Imperial College London. Anita's here now to tell me more about her work and why breathing is sometimes more complicated than you might think. So Anita, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming in. Can I just ask you to just set the scene for us a bit about your clinical work? What conditions might a patient come in to see you for?
I see patients with a range of disorders. Some of them have sleep apnea. They stop breathing when they're asleep. Some of them have muscle conditions, muscular dystrophies, or they have motor neurone disease, or they have a chronic lung condition such as chronic bronchitis, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. All those conditions can lead to breathing failure during the day if they're at a severe level. And interestingly, one of the things that happens first is those people develop breathing problems during sleep. And if that's not addressed, they progress to breathing failure during the day.
And so what happens if you don't breathe properly? I mean, it might seem obvious that if you don't breathe properly, you faint and you can't, your muscular processes and things may not work. But in these chronic conditions, what actually happens?
Well, if you don't breathe properly when you're asleep, there are initially small changes in the oxygen level and the carbon dioxide level. And the body actually has quite a good correcting mechanism in that it'll wake you to a lighter level of sleep. So one of the first things people notice if they have these problems is they're not sleeping well. But after a while, you can't correct enough. You can't carry on sacrificing your sleep. The oxygen level deteriorates further at night, and the carbon dioxide level, the waste gas level, can rise. People can wake at night with a panic sensation. They can feel rough, as if they've got a hangover when they wake in the morning. And that progresses over time if it's not treated with breathing support, and those individuals can run into severe problems, have to be admitted as an emergency.
Does it go further than, how far does it go rather? Can you get to cognitive or cardiovascular problems?
Yeah, that's a good point. By dropping your oxygen level at night, that has all sorts of consequences long term. So as you indicate, it can affect brain function. decision-making function, memory, for example, but also make you sleepy during the day. As I mentioned, as the body tries to protect you and keep you at lighter levels of sleep overnight, people end up with chronic sleep deprivation.
But also, I mean, never mind the sleep side of this one for just a moment. There are many more serious conditions that cause you to have problems just being able to breathe during the day. So take us through some of those, and then this is sort of more the focus of your research.
Yes, those conditions would include problems that affect the breathing muscles. So muscular dystrophies, one of the commonest is Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a genetic condition that occurs in boys. Spinal muscular atrophy, another common condition that involves the respiratory muscles, and a range of other muscle disorders, including, for example, in the past, polio. Poliomyelitis, classically viral infection, affects the respiratory muscles. Of course, with the polio vaccination now, people don't get polio, but there are still individuals around who caught polio in the last lot of epidemics in the 1950s who have borderline muscle function, and some of them need breathing support as well.
So let's move on to this question of breathing support. The idea of helping somebody breathe with a machine is not new at all. And in fact, over time, we've sort of seen quite gruesome contraptions that do this, because things like iron lungs and so on.
Yes.
So give me a potted history of where medics and others have tried to help people with these more serious conditions, how to help them literally breathe, because if you can't breathe, you won't survive for very long at all.
No, I think that takes us back to the 1800s, and probably the first iron lung description was in 1838. Alexander Graham Bell, who everyone knows invented the telephone, but also, sadly, his eldest child died within a few hours of birth, and shortly after he came of respiratory distress, and he came up with the idea of using negative pressure. So an iron lung works by exerting negative pressure around the chest. If you do that, you suck the chest upwards, air has to go into the nose and mouth.
So that's how it breathes for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And so Bell came up with that idea. It was further developed, and it really with electricity coming in, the first motorized iron lung was came along in about the 1930s in the USA, quickly came across to the UK, and that was just as well, because in the 30s, 40s and 50s, that was the time of the terrible polio epidemics, and the iron lungs, as I think a lot of people know, were used at that time to support people with acute polio.
So these things weren't cheap. And so it's not like you could just give one to everyone with polio. So I want to talk about how they were developed beyond then, because we don't really see them nowadays.
No, things have moved on. You're right, they were expensive.
And I'm assuming that the quality of life, again, talking about that, can't have been very good.
You were enclosed totally, you were immobile. They were hugely cumbersome to manage. You mentioned the cost. The earliest ones cost about $1,500 in the USA, which at that time was equivalent to the cost of a new built house there. This was pre-NHS in the UK, pre-Beveridge, and in fact Lord Nuffield, so a private initiative, actually, well, a philanthropic initiative, funded the iron lungs in this country. But because of all their disadvantages, and also because particularly in Denmark in the 1950s, there was a polio variant that caused the upper airway muscles to be weak, as well as the usual diaphragm and breathing muscles. And if someone has problems with the upper airway, an iron lung doesn't work. It actually sucks the airway shut. So the mortality was very high. 90% of people died. And they moved to positive pressure ventilation, which is the opposite, but applying positive pressure to the airway. And we moved forward from then, which is in the late 50s. That was really the beginning of intensive care units, which is a whole different story, but intubating patients with a tube in the airway. But not everyone requires a tube in the airway. And more latterly, up to the present time, the newest way of supporting the breathing, non-invasively is with masks. And we now have patients on my ward at the moment and wards up and down the country having their breathing supported with a ventilator but with a mask. And that can deal with acute problems, acute chest infections, but also can support people long-term at home.
So this is the equivalent of an iron lung, but it's much more, it allows the people to be much more mobile and independent, of course.
Exactly. And our patients are busy, they want to do things, they travel, they go on holiday. We've had a patient go to base camp at Mount Everest with their ventilator. Another is a travel writer who's been all the way around India. He continues to use his ventilator at night and for rest during the day, but then he does all his interviews and his travel writing in between times.
Now, so in terms of the technology then, you mentioned intensive care. So, of course, that is a relatively new discipline, taking people to these sort of extremes of physiology, in a sense, and allowing people to survive very extreme conditions. But then the interesting thing, of course, is that from there you can use it on an everyday, you can use the elements of it for everyday reasons like your patients. And so where are these bits of technology going next? I mean, are we thinking, is it just going to get smaller, faster, cheaper, or do you sort of think what we need to do is look at the cause of these conditions, start to research those and deal with that?
Both, because I think if you understand the mechanism of what's going wrong, you're better able to treat it. But the directions we're going in are, firstly, if you apply the treatment quickly enough, you can avoid patients going to intensive care. So you can treat them on general medical wards. That's better for them. It's better for the health service, so we can avoid intensive care admissions. We can also help patients who've got stuck on a ventilator in intensive care and wean them quickly off that using non-invasive ventilation. We've moved to other areas, for example, in children, supporting the breathing in children with a range of conditions, and some other areas where I think we can help, not necessarily in extending life expectancy hugely, but in helping symptomatically in progressive conditions like motor neurone disease. In fact, it's the only treatment in motor neurone disease that can extend life expectancy. And can improve quality of life because it reduces the breathlessness and the symptoms associated with fragmented sleep.
So you're one of the things that is going to happen fairly soon, or may already have happened, is that you're opening up, of course, a new research centre, the Royal Brompton Centre for Sleep. I imagine we've talked a little bit about some of the things you want to do there, but sort of what's the aims of that? What specifically about sleep will you be studying?
It'll be a sort of two-pronged service. Firstly, it's clinical, because there's a huge need now. Sleep apnea is very common. Maybe 4% of men, 2% of women have it, probably more actually, and the incidence will increase and prevalence will increase with increasing obesity. So there will be a clinical service so we can see more patients.
What's the normal treatment for that though?
That's a version of positive. Well, we hope patients will lose weight, but the main treatment is a variant of this positive pressure ventilation, which is called continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP. Many people listening may know of this or have relatives who are using it. So there will be the clinical service that we can improve and enhance. On the research side, we are interested in the cognitive impact, so the effect of sleep apnea on brain function and on verbal memory. In fact, it impairs that, and a study we're involved in at the moment is showing that our interim analysis suggests that those problems you can reverse with the CPAP therapy, and we'll continue our work on non-invasive ventilation in the muscle disorders as well.
Can you give me a sense of what the situation is now with all the technology you have and the sort of research that you're doing in the institutes like yours and others around the world? How many people with breathing difficulties are living happier, longer, actually living, compared to maybe 100 years ago when we had iron lungs and we didn't understand the situation with different ways to help people breathe? I mean, is there a marked difference in survival and quality of life?
Particularly, I think, in respiratory failure, because before we had oxygen therapy, but if you're in ventilatory failure, oxygen can push the carbon dioxide level up. So if you've gone into breathing failure, the likelihood is that you're going to die in the next few years. With Duchenne muscular dystrophy, 90% of those people will be dead within a year, unfortunately, if their carbon dioxide level is elevated. If you put those people on non-invasive ventilation, for example, the patients with old polio, they will probably live to their normal life expectancy. In the Duchenne patients I just mentioned, instead of dying within a year, now about and the average age, median age of survival in Duchenne muscular dystrophy pre-ventilatory support was about 18 years. Now, with the ventilatory support, about a third of our patients live into their 30s and early 40s, and the median survival has gone from 18 to about 30 years of age. So you change a condition which people died of in their teens or even in childhood, and people are now going to middle age. And some of those that had problems, like with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in middle age, will now live much to an older age.
You know, talking to you about breathing for the last 15 minutes, I'm just very conscious of my own breathing. Yes. And then you realise sometimes you get out of breath. You know, do you find yourself doing that? You must be a perfect breather. That sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but you know what I mean? Sometimes you're out of breath.
I know, exactly. But the problem about breathing is when you talk to someone about it, it will always affect them thinking about it will affect their breathing.
I think I don't breathe deeply enough. That's my problem.
I'm sure your oxygen carbon dioxide levels are okay.
Well, that's a clinical fact. Anita, that's been really, really interesting. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anita spoke about her work as part of a series of lectures at Imperial College London. These talks run until April, and you can go along to any of them. To find out more, go to imperial.ac.uk/events. We'll put some links up to those lectures on our blog. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.